I'm author and athlete Brad Kearns. Welcome to the Be Rad Podcast, where we explore ways to pursue peak performance with passion throughout life. Visit bradkearns.com for great resources on healthy eating, exercise, and lifestyle. And here we go with the show.
I'm glad I'm not seriously competitive anymore, because this is the worst thing you can possibly do, is undermine all your beliefs in the things that make you faster. I think there are very few people walking on this planet who can say, yeah, that time I ran, my best time, that's as fast as my genes would permit me to run. Running has prepared me well for the idea that even if everything I'm dreaming of comes true, life will go on the next day and I'll have to think of other dreams, because you can't just sort of float on that cloud indefinitely.
I'm so excited to introduce you to Peluva. This is a new zero-drop minimalist shoe with the distinctive five-toe design from my main man, Mark Sisson. Peluvas give you the most authentic barefoot-style experience, but with sufficient cushioning so you can use them for all manner of daily movement, especially walking and many other fitness and athletic activities. Peluvas are also incredibly stylish, so you get a barefoot shoe that you're not embarrassed to wear around in daily life. It's been so cool to see the popularity of minimalist shoes grow over the recent years, but Peluvas are a step ahead of every other zero-drop wide-box shoe because of the critical feature of individual five-toe articulation, a separate slot for each of your toes. This allows for correct dynamic movement of the foot through the walking or running stride, which is impossible when your toes are encased into a single box, even a wide box. Well, you might know that minimalist shoes have faced controversy in recent years for causing injuries from inappropriate use. So here is the big picture mission. We want to get you walking in Peluvas, living in your Peluvas, going barefoot in your home or other safe areas as often as possible. Go ahead and use your specialized cushiony running shoes or your basketball shoes, work boots, high heels, things that you want to wear when you want to wear them, but wear your Peluvas as much as possible to reawaken the natural functionality of the human foot to stand, walk, run, and perform. Do you want to try a pair? I'm certain that when you put them on and walk around, you are going to quickly realize that these are the most comfortable natural shoes that you've ever worn. They are designed to feel like you're, quote, walking barefoot on a putting green. Please visit Peluva.com, that's P-E-L-U-V-A, and use the code BRADPODCAST and get 10% off your first pair. Peluvas, let your feet be feet. Hey, listeners, welcome to a very interesting and fast-moving conversation with Alex Hutchinson, the best-selling author of the wonderful book Endure. He's a very popular columnist in Outside Magazine, covering topics related to sweat science. That's right. He is the expert on the scientific aspects of peak performance and the human limitations, especially relating to endurance. And I spend a fair amount of time at the start of the show having him recount his most extraordinary story of amazing improvement breakthroughs in his own running career as a middle distance runner in college. You're not going to believe some of these insights that are going to pull out. And they'll be really memorable. I can't stop thinking about his story when I first heard about it. I had to have him on the show. And we get into all kinds of aspects, including the popular central governor theory promoted by Dr. Timothy Noakes, which proposes that the brain is the true limiter of peak performance, not the fatigue that's happening in our muscles, in our extremities. And we also transition into talking about the ultimate limits of human performance, especially as it relates to the current world records and all the technological breakthroughs, as well as the training breakthroughs, where we're headed in the future. And I'll tee him up a little further with an excerpt from his book description about Endure, where Hutchinson reveals that a wave of paradigm-altering research over the past decade suggests that the seemingly physical barriers you encounter are mediated as much by your brain as much by your body. It's not all in your head. For each of the physical limits that Hutchinson explores, pain, muscle, oxygen, heat, thirst, and fuel, he carefully disentangles the delicate interplay of mind and muscle by telling the riveting stories of men and women who've approached and sometimes surpassed their own ultimate limits. And there's great stories about the explorers that went to the South Pole, Asmundsen 100 plus years ago, and then recent efforts to kind of duplicate these amazing feats that you hear about in the history books. And I also like how he blends that mind and body insights where it's not all in your head, but a lot of it is. And if you, for example, adopt a more empowering positive attitude about the journey that you're on, the exercise that you're doing, the workout that you're trying to finish, instead of feeling negative about it and wishing it for it to be over, you can say, boy, isn't the fresh air and this beautiful scenery wonderful? What a great way to spend my day. And thereby, you reduce your perceived exertion and you prolong your endurance. It's pretty awesome. So let's hear from Alex Hutchinson. Alex Hutchinson, I'm so glad to connect with you. And we have all kinds of important stuff to talk about. Hopefully listeners are familiar with your wonderful book, Endure, and read your columns in Outside Magazine and Runner's World. That's the main place we're seeing these regular features.
These days, Outside is the main place, yeah. I was with Runner's World for a while, but anyway, Outside, and thank you for having me on, Brad. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
So this concept of human endurance and all the aspects and attributes about that that you covered so nicely in your book, I think we have some important things to talk about, but I can't think of a better way to set the stage than to ask you to recap your amazing journey in distance running, where you became quite a serious runner, but the breakthroughs are to the level that I've never heard about of any other human ever. And it turns out you're the guy studying this. So I think you're going to have to wind us up, man, and take us back to your high school and college days in Canada, pursuing your dream of becoming a middle distance runner.
Yeah. I mean, I started out in high school, like a lot of people do, and running initially middle distance, like 1500 meters. And the big dream at that point was the call it the metric 4 minute mile. I wanted to run 4 minutes for 1500 meters, which is about, call it 17 seconds shorter than a mile. So I was not trying to be Roger Bannister, but my own version of Roger Bannister. And I ran 4:02 in my second year of high school running. And I could plot out the trajectory, right? I could see that I was going to go well under 4 minutes the next year and, you know, make the Olympics the year after that and set the world right. You know, I had it all plotted out. But I hit a plateau pretty quickly. I ran between 4 flat and 4:02 for what turned out to be 4 straight years, which took me to my junior year of college. And so, you know, when I talk about human limits and discovering where the outer bounds of your potential are, that really goes back to that feeling that I had in high school and college, where it's like, okay, I know I've been training pretty hard for 4 years now. I've been doing the mileage, I've been hitting the weight room, I've been doing the speed work, I've been lying awake at night reading books about running, and I keep running about 4 minutes for 1500, just over 4 minutes. So I was very confident that I could get under 4 minutes, that I could run that 3:59. But I definitely had the sense that that was about what my body was capable of, that there wasn't a whole lot more in the tank. And so the turning point for me was a race in my junior year of college, not an important race, not a significant race, but just another race where I was going to go out and try and get that 3:59.9. And it was an indoor race, so 200 meter track. The gun went off and I took off in the lead trying to run my pace. And I went through the first 200 meters in, you know, the timekeepers there at the start line calling out splits. And I went through the first 227 seconds, which for anyone who's done any track running, knows that's pretty fast, and it's a hell of a lot faster than you want to be running if you're trying to run 4 minutes for 1500, which is 32 second pace. And I had this, I still can remember the sort of moment of like, whoa, that's way too fast. And yet, whoa, I feel pretty good. I actually feel under control. So, you know, I was just trying to stay calm, stay cool, came through the second lap in 57 seconds, which again is way too fast. But I felt just really, really under control and good. Same thing happened third lap. And so I had this, I can also remember, this is a race that took place in 1996. I'm an old guy now. But I can still remember that mid-race kind of decision of, or the realization that something special was happening and that I needed to kind of stop listening to splits, stop overthinking things and just run, because I was having a very, very special day. And it turned out to be a special day. I ran 352.4, which was a 9 second or, you know, almost 9 second personal best. And what happened afterwards was so that was cool in and of itself. Like 9 seconds is a lot, but what happened afterwards is I was chatting to a teammate who had taken my splits for me so that I, you know, as being a typical distance runner, I was ready to record the splits in my log and analyze them and plot them in Lotus 1-2-3 and all that stuff. And I said, can you believe I ran the first lap in 27? He said, no, you didn't. What are you talking about? You ran the first lap in like 30 or 31. And anyway, to cut to the, sorry, I'm making this a long story, but to cut to the chase, the timekeeper had probably missed the start or something like that and was giving me the wrong splits. And so when he was telling me I'd gone out in 27, he was creating this impression in my mind that I was running really fast with less effort than normal. Whereas in reality, I was running pretty fast with pretty, you know, moderate effort, but he kind of tricked me into thinking I was having the best day of my life. And as a result, I kind of unshackled myself from my prior expectations and I just ran. And all of a sudden I had a 9 second personal best. And then, you know, the postscript is that in the race after that, I ran 349. And after that, I ran 344. And it was like a kind of tap had been turned on. And, you know, honestly, I wish I could recapture that that sort of sequence of events. You know, if I could have bottled that, I would have gotten a lot faster, but I didn't. You know, I eventually hit another plateau, and it's not as knowing that there are such things as mental barriers doesn't mean it's easy to turn them off, but it definitely, that one race in 1996, I think, is what set me on a path that ended up with the book I published in 2018, Endure, because I've been fascinated ever since, but trying to understand what defines our limits, and knowing that that it's not just a formula, you know, it's not a VO2 max test. It's not that there's a lot more in there that defines what we're capable of.
In other words, you're still trying to figure it out 20 plus years later. We still don't know what happened to this guy.
I would say I'm even, in some ways I'm even more confused than I was then. The less you know, the more you think you know. And so the deeper I've gotten into it, the more I realize that there's a lot still to learn for sure.
That's the sign of a good scientist, when you keep heading toward more realization that you realize how little you know. So congratulations there. Yeah. Instead of here's Alex, who knows everything about endurance and performance limitations. Let's hear from him. No,
it would be nice.
Yeah. So I want to set the context there. When you're around a 4 minute 1500 meter runner, that is I'd say very good high school level, probably national caliber Canada, or, you know, in America, you'd be one of the top guys in the state and you'd be looking at a college career. And then, you know, hopefully they were hoping you would improve. But if you're running 4 minutes in college, you're a pretty good and very highly trained runner. So it's not someone who's jumping into their second race and getting a 9 second PR. So there was absolutely no, there was no dream of anyone at your already pretty fast level popping out a 9 second PR. And I've heard it's just unheard of.
So, I mean, yeah, to sort of expand on that context, when I started running, I think I ran my, like everyone else, I ran, you know, untrained stuff in early high school. And then I had showed some promise. I joined a track club in Canada. Track clubs are fairly common outside of high school. And I think I ran like 444, 445 for my first race. And then I got some training in and I ran 428. And this is all within one season. And then I went to the city finals and I ran 419. And then I went to the regionals and I ran 417. And then I went to the provincial finals, which is our equivalent state finals, and I ran 413 in the heats and 408 in the final. So there was this sort of 20 seconds over the course of, a month, let's say. That's not mysterious. That's training. That's learning how to race. That's very, very common. But as you say, once you've been training for a while, the fruits become much harder to grasp. And I always say, you know, whenever I'm talking to people, and whenever someone comes up to me and they say, "Oh yeah, I had an okay race. It was a best time, but only by a second." I'm like, never take a best time for granted, because they get a lot. The farther you get in the sport, the harder they are to get. And so by the time I was running 4 minute, you know, 402 for 1500, I've been training with a track club for a few years. I've been, running 6 or 7 days a week, doing interval workouts with a very good coach who knew what he was doing. So I wasn't just sort of bumbling along and discovering the sort of secrets of life. And in fact, you know, so I told this story in my book, right? And so people have heard it. And my old high school coach, when he read it. He's like, you know, trying to remember those days. He's like, surely there were some signs in your training that you were ready for a big breakthrough. And I was like, well, you know, you can always find, you know, if you look carefully enough, you can say, oh, maybe that will work out, suggest something. But look, I'll give you my training logs. I'll take out my training logs. You tell me if you think I was ready to get 17 seconds faster over the course of a few weeks. So I gave him my old training logs and he took them home. Actually, he still has them. He's giving them back to me. But anyway, he took them home and he, you know, we chatted a couple of weeks later and I said, so, well, you know, what's the deal? And he said, yeah, you know, there was no like, so before I had my breakthrough, it was clear I was ready to run under 4 minutes. So I was working out better than a 4 minute guy, but I was not working out like a 3:44 guy, which I ended up. So it's like, I went from slightly underperforming to dramatically underperforming. But it was, the change wasn't that I started working out better. I'd been working out at that level for a year or two without any, there was no obvious sign in the training that something had changed.
Right. So you were stuck running slower than you quote unquote should based on your impressive training log.
Yeah, no, I not a ton, I would say. Like the trainings that I should have probably run, you know, under maybe 3:55, 3:58, 3:57, something like under 4 minutes. I was never like a hero trainer or anything. And I, you know, that's another topic, obviously.
Right.
I don't think this is necessarily a good thing to be a hero trainer. Like I think it's a good thing to sort of keep your powder dry. But yeah, there was I think people thought I should be ready to break four, but breaking four and running 3:52 are two different things.
Interesting. I didn't know about your early progression from novice and then down to a provincial finalist. So that's very interesting because you had this pattern wired into your brain of a guy who just kept knocking, you know, slashing the clock, even though it was, as you described, expected when someone starts putting on the shoes and running around a track and practicing, you expect that. But you did have that reference point somewhere in the recesses of your consciousness that it's already happened. So here it goes again with the 9 second PR. And then you didn't rest there.
I think that's a really interesting point. And I think it's probably connected to the fact that, first of all, I kept training at a very serious level with running as one of the most important thing in my life into my 30s, and I'm 46 now and I'm still training every day. I think it reminds me of those that, you know, they did those conditioning experiments with like rats or whatever, or I'm maybe not describing this right, like the psychology experiments, long, you know, half a century ago, where they find the best way to get a rat to keep pressing a lever is not that five presses gives you a nugget of food. It's that an unpredictable, every once in a while, you hit the jackpot. And this is the way casino slot machines are designed too. It's like the unpredictable. So I had this hardwired into me that you just keep training. Sometimes it seems like nothing is happening. And every once in a while, bam, you hit a hot streak. And so I kept waiting and waiting and waiting to go, you know, to get another, more hot streaks and to go on another tear, because I've had this happen a few times where it's like, you're in a plateau, you're in a plateau. Then once you finally break through, you know, when it rains, it pours. So, yeah, maybe I'm like the rat in the cage there expecting the big reward nugget at some point.
Tristan Harris calls it intermittent variable rewards. And that's why slot machines are so addicting. And I guess perhaps running, especially in your case, not for most runners, because they don't have these incredible breakthroughs. They're not too common, but that's interesting. You know, it kept you in the game. And I guess we should... we should talk about your time progression there. So you were a pretty good college runner, and then you shattered the barriers with that 3:52. But then to take it in a matter of weeks, now all of a sudden you're national class and you're lining up with the Canadian heroes and Olympians. So that part, how do you justify going from what you finally hit your potential and maybe even better than your predicted potential, and now you're in the stratosphere somehow?
That was a really interesting experience.
And did you get totally full of yourself, swagger around campus with the gold chain now all of a sudden? How did that go in your psychology?
The gold chain that I'm wearing right now, yeah. it's interesting because, you know, to go back to the context of as a 401 guy, I had big dreams. We all have big dreams. I went to bed every night dreaming big dreams. But those big dreams were like, someday I'll run 3:53 or 3:54 or 3:55. And so all of a sudden I ran 3:44. And that race was, I mean, there's a whole story to that race too, because that's another big gap to go from 3:49 to 3:44. I was in the fast heat of a meet where I should have been. Everyone else was in the, it was a meet held at my university. And I remember showing up a few hours before the race and looking at the heat sheets posted on the wall and seeing that I was in the faster heat. And there were a couple guys standing there reading the heat sheets, and they were saying, what the hell is Hutchinson doing in this fast heat? What the hell? I run faster. We should be, you know, like, the people were angry about that because my coach was the meet director and had put me in the fast heat ahead of a bunch of guys who were faster than me. And so when I stepped to the line that day, you know, this is a different element of psychology. Mm. It was like, I was like, I have to finish second last. I have to finish second last so that I'm not the one who should have been in the last heat. And so I ran in dead last in that race for 1200 meters. And then with 300 meters to go in the race, I did a little internal check and was like, hey, I've still got fuel to burn. And I passed about eight people in the last 300 meters. And it was a huge race. Like almost probably more surprising than the 352 in a lot of ways. It's harder to explain, but as 344 is a different world than 352, more so than 352 to 401. And so that actually
exponentially more so, of course, because now you're bumping up against Olympic caliber playing.
This was in the mid 90s, which another important piece of context is people were slower in the mid 90s. So these days, 344 wouldn't get you a ticket to any big meets. But at the time in Canada, which is a smaller country, it had qualified me for the Olympic trials a few weeks later. And so I found myself suddenly, 2 months ago, I was a 401 guy. Now I'm stepping to the start line against the Canadian record holder. And there's I guess I mentioned this in the book, there's a YouTube video of the 1996 Canadian Olympic trials. And I'm on the start line next to my absolute hero, Graham Hood, who's made the Olympic finals already. He's an Olympic finalist, defending Olympic finalist. I am just absolutely petrified. And the way that worked out is I ran like a hunk of crap in the Olympic finals. After the semis, I made it to the final, but I ran like junk. I didn't yet believe that I belonged. And I came back 12 months later. It took me that long to be like, no, I've run these times in the low 340s. I belong here. And the next time the next year I came fourth at the national championships, and I wasn't necessarily all that much fitter, but I ran with confidence instead of running scared out of my mind and thinking that I didn't belong with those people.
I guess it's hard for a lot of endurance athletes, myself included, to buy into this idea that our mindset is holding us back, because I know what that last lap feels like, or that last mile, 3 miles of the marathon, or whatever your reference point is, where you say, no, there's no way I could have gone any farther, and this is how well I'm trained, and so forth. But this opens up, I think, a whole bunch of avenues for discussion. The central governor theory that's been popularized by Dr. Tim Noakes, and that you covered nicely in your book. It's really fascinating to me that the brain is suggested that it's the ultimate arbiter of performance limitation, rather than that your muscles actually got tired and your lower back cramped and this and that. So I'd love to just get going on that discussion. And also, let's say it is true, and we all have reference points where we had these amazing breakthroughs and we made it to the top of the mountain, even though we were tired and it was pouring rain. But then how do you balance that insight with day-to-day regulation of your energy so you don't get overtrained and burnt out?
Yeah,
well, and I'll be back in 15 minutes, Alex, because exactly. I just teed you up big time.
I was just going to say, there's a lot to unpack there. I think the first thing I want to say is to agree with what you said about it being difficult to, certainly for me, and I think for a lot of other people, to really, really, truly believe that, the thoughts in your head are going to affect your performance, because nothing feels as objectively real and true as the feeling of muscular fatigue or at the end of a race. You don't feel like, oh, I could have chosen to gone faster. Like, especially once you've trained for a certain amount of time and you're highly motivated and you're starting a race thinking, I would stab myself with a needle to, I should say safety pin, so it doesn't sound like I'm doping myself. I would stab myself with a safety pin if that would make me run faster. I'm willing to accept all pain. And then in the end of the race, you're going as hard as you can and you just couldn't go any faster. So then someone comes up to you and says, boy, maybe if you thought, thinking, positive thoughts, you would have gone faster. You're like, what are you talking about? So I really struggled with that. And I am a very empirical sort of show me the evidence. Like, if you think this helps, show me a double-blinded peer-reviewed study that demonstrates it. And so I had to balance, or I had to hold in opposition that approach to the world, which I think is pretty common among endurance athletes. They tend not to generalize, but they tend to be a fairly analytical species. I had to balance that with my own experiences that we've just been talking about of like, oh, all of a sudden I got a lot faster. How did that happen? And so then when I came across Tim Noakes's research about the central governor model, this idea that your limits are dictated by your brain trying to prevent you from reaching the edge of your physical capacities rather than that you actually reach your physical capacities, it made sense to me because I couldn't find any other way of reconciling this, the feeling of what it's like at the end of a race, the feeling that you've really hit your limits, with the reality that when I ran 4 flat or 4:01, I thought I was going as hard as I could. When I ran 3:52, I also thought it didn't feel that different. I wasn't more tired at the end. So how do you explain those differences? And I think even through the writing Endure, which delves into this stuff a lot, I gave a talk not long after the book came out, and someone stuck up their hand at the end saying, I read the last chapter and it sounded to me like you actually still don't believe it. Like the end of the book is like saying something about, I can't remember the line, but it's something like there's more, when you're pushing as hard as you can, there's more in there if you can convince yourself to believe it or something. And it's, I thought about it and it was one of those moments where I had the sense that, oh, this someone else on the exterior of my brain was able to perceive what I was thinking better than I was. And I realized that, yeah, you're right. Even in writing the book, I still am skeptical. I still have trouble accepting the idea that that our thoughts have such an important role to play. So it's something I struggle with to this day, to be honest.
Yeah, I would say, being that you've spent your career and you have that analytical bent, as you describe, and I can totally relate to that. And I remember back when I was racing on the professional triathlon circuit, mixing with some of the best athletes, and some of them were completely raw and intuitive and non-scientific minded. And it seemed, especially to me, analyzing the situation, that could be considered an ideal competitive mindset, where you're just out there and you're tapping into these raw instincts. And if you get your ass kicked, you say, F that, I can't wait till the next race. And instead of breaking down your nutritional macronutrients and the 3-week buildup to see if, there's some area that you can identify, I wonder if you've mixed with, athletes with a vastly different mindset and approach than you, and see any compare and contrast to what represents kind of the ideal competitive disposition.
100%. Lots of things to say. One is, I don't think there's an ideal competitive disposition. There's there's many roads to road, right? Mm-hmm. But there are some very different ones. And I will say, once I got into being a science journalist, then where my sort of main job was, let's look at studies testing all the theories that athletes have about what makes them faster, and let's look at the evidence and let's debunk all these mistaken beliefs, I pretty quickly came to the conclusion, I'm glad I'm not seriously competitive anymore, because this is the worst thing you can possibly do, is undermine all your beliefs in the things that make you faster. Because I have had experiences like the one you described. And in fact, I had a coach in the early 2000s. I trained with a group run by Matt Centrowitz Sr., the former American 5,000 meter record holder, the father of the 2016 Olympic 1500 meter champion. And he just had a completely different approach than I did. He was an extremely intuitive athlete. He was a very talented, intuitive coach, rather. And as an athlete, he'd been an intuitive athlete. He qualified for the Olympics as a college student in the 70s. And he wasn't interested in, let's do this kind of interval at this percentage of VO2 max in order to optimize this physiological system. He was very much just kind of feeling it. And I remember let me tell a couple of stories, because one was, he'd tell me to go out and do a fartlek. And I'd say, well, how long should the fartlek? I don't know, whatever, make sure it's a good effort. You need to get some mileage in. Say, okay, well, how long should the hard surges be? And how long should the recoveries be? You'd say, well, go hard until you feel like you've pushed hard enough, then take a break till you recover, then go hard again. And my head would be on the verge of exploding. I'd be like, no, I need to know how many minutes I'm going hard. How can I know how hard to go until I know how many minutes I'm supposed to go and how much the rest is? But he was trying to teach me something that I wasn't quite ready to learn at the time, to feel where my limits are and then to step back from them and to feel them again. And the other story, just on that note, from that, he had a couple, while I was there, he had a couple runners qualify for the NCAA championships, a couple milers. And so before they left, he pulled them over during practice one day to give them some tactical advice. And I was, since I was a competitive miler at a similar level, I was in that group, sort of listening to his advice to them before going to the NCAA championships, which, and 1500 meter races are famously tactical. Usually it's not just the gun goes and everyone runs as fast as they can, especially in the qualifying rounds. There's a lot of, like, it'll go slow, it'll go fast, there'll be a move, there'll be a counter move, everyone's watching everyone else in a big pack, and then there'll be a big move that you can't miss, and then a counter move, and so knowing when to go. And so Coach Centrowitz was trying to explain to these guys, here's what you need to do. And it wasn't like you run at this pace until 600 to go. 600, you go into gear four, and then at 300 to go, you got to go into gear five. He was like, you know, when you walk into a bar and you can sense there's going to be a fight soon, you can just sense in the, and I was thinking, like,
No.
hell no, I've never seen a fight in my life. I don't know anything what's up. But he's like, yeah, you go in a bar, you can sense, someone's gonna start something soon. There's just that electricity in the air, and you gotta feel it. Don't go too soon, but wait. You just gotta wait until the moment just before you know the first punch is gonna be thrown. Bam! You throw your punch. And I was like, I love that advice. I don't know how to follow it. But the two guys, Sean Duffy and Sean O'Brien, who were great milers for American, they learned to trust Coach Centrowitz to just sort of, and they sort of got in tune with them, and they were great runners as a result. And they but they learned this intuitive approach that escaped me. And so I think it's not to say there was nothing that could have been optimized or changed about the program there, but there was an important lesson. In retrospect, I look back, and even at the time, I had to sense, there's a language here, there's a lesson here that is hard for me to learn, and that I would be better if I could learn it. And that's to do with sort of being able to feel where your limits are, and rather than letting them be externally imposed by some idea of how fast you should be able to run.
Yeah, and also that fear you describe when you got up to the big leagues really quickly without that proper psychological preparation. And so of course you feel like you don't deserve to be standing next to Graham Hood and shaking his hand. Good luck, man. I'll see you at the finish line. And I think most people can relate to that. And I'm thinking of my time that I shared with Lance Armstrong when he was a triathlete, and then later during his Tour de France career, I wrote a book about him and had some time to interview him and things. And he sort of projected the opposite, where even when he was a kid, and if you know his story, he came in and started racing against the top pros in the world in triathlon when he was 15, 16 years old. And I'd meet with this guy at the races, and he was absolutely fearless, and he had no reverence for even the greatest athletes, who were my heroes that I'd worked hard to finally get up to be able to compete with them. And it was such an honor to compete with these great guys. He was like, oh, those guys are wussies. I'm going to take it out hard on the bike and make everyone suffer. And he'd verbalize these things as a punk kid. And he came off poorly in many ways with the media at first because he was so brash and cocky. But to me, it was such a rich experience to look at this guy who was not just blow hard. He deeply, thought and believed that and embodied that persona. And it seemed like, and I talk about this in the book I wrote about him, that, I asked him, do you feel those nervousness and that pressure when you're leading this team? And in fact, the entire organization is counting on you winning the tour. And he goes, no. And I go, why not? You mean you're the man, you have the most pressure of anybody. And he goes, oh, no. The guys who have the real pressure are the ones fighting for their jobs to be the domestique, and they got to hand me the water bottle or they get fired. He says, I'm the guy who prepares properly. And so when I go to the tour, I'm not afraid to win, and I'm not afraid to lose either. And I thought, like, what else can you say that's better competitive temperament than just being absolutely fearless of all outcomes? And you certainly embodied that because you were fearless to make a 9-second PR. Maybe the timer helped, the poor French translation or whatever they did. But somehow you broke through to that realm, at least temporarily, and got to float in the atmosphere.
Yeah, and you could think of these things. our traits are not fixed in concrete, so we can exist on different ends of that spectrum. But if Lance is on one extreme spectrum of confidence, and let's say when I got to my first Olympic trials, I was on the other spectrum of thinking I don't belong there, I would say that most people, like, you could say at that Olympic trials, I felt I didn't really belong there. I was not competitive. I was not as ready to race with those guys. But in a lot of cases, and I think this is sort of a life insight, even when we do belong, the most of us, it's more common to err on the side of, you know, the imposter syndrome feeling like you don't belong even when you do.
Right. What are you doing on the bestseller list, Alex? Come on. These are, John Grisham. Yeah.
Okay. And in every context, you know, this is a very common thing. And it has repercussions, I think. Like, in part, it can make you work harder. It can fuel you to make sure you prove you do belong. But I think it can be a real drain on your energy if you're constantly worried that that actually people are going to discover that you don't belong there, that you don't belong on that start line. You're not as good as your competitors, where in reality, often you are and you do.
So you talked yourself into that. It took you a year, and then you got back to the Nationals and placed highly. But then you describe hitting that plateau, which seems to be expected because your plateau is a national caliber runner who's training extremely hard and right on the razor edge of success or failure by definition, trying to hit that highest point. Do you think there's now a genetic component or some other missing link that allowed you to, you had tremendous genetic talent to be able to run up to 3:44, and then why didn't you break El Guerrouj's record since you had all that exercise physiology background?
Yeah, so I ended up running 3:42. Just I have to set the record straight. Ooh. On that.
Okay, legit sub 4 minute mile for you American listeners.
If you go to the official World Athletics conversion tables, my 1500 PR works out to a 4:01. I will take that to my grave. I will swear to my grave that personally my endurance profile is stronger than my speed, so I would have run 3:59.9.
Well, now we have the springy spike, so you're a 3:57 miler by today's
definition.
I'd be like
a 3:20
miler.
So let me start with the excuses. I ran 3:42 in 97 when I was 21. I got injured the next year. And I missed the next three years. I missed the next two track seasons completely. And I just was starting to come back running like 20 miles a week in that third year. And when I came back, I never quite got my snap back. I ran 3:43 a few years later, and I ran a 13:52 5K. So I was basically at a lower, I never got back to the level I was at in 97 as a 21-year-old. So I can blame a little bit that I had this knee problem that kept me out for a couple of years. But so I think even that the fitness I was at in 97, had I gotten into a fast race, maybe there was a 3:39 there or something like that. But there was no 3:35, and there was definitely no 3:32, and there was 100% no 3:29 or 3:25. Like there's, you know, I'm at level whatever, 14, and I'm, you know, we're talking about level 60. I'm a long way from those. And so genetics, yeah, a lot of it was genetics. But I guess what I would, if I sort of push myself to think about this, I would say that genetics had very little to do with where I ended up on the spec. Like, let's say genetics is going to say Alex was never going to run 3:32. I don't think my genetics precluded me from running, let's say, 3:35 or something, which is still a long, long way from what I actually ran. And so then why didn't I run faster? Well, I was an extremely nervous racer. I was too cautious. All of my races once I got to that level started out slow and finished fast. I ran my 3:42 on 40 miles a week, which is really quite low for that level of running. It's not that I was stupid. I understood that 80 miles a week would be better. But I had a lot of trouble getting up that high without injury. Like, in fact, I was trying to raise my mileage when I got injured and was out for a few years. And I don't think genetics is what explains why I got injured. I don't think that was impossible. If you gave me 10 lives to live, In some of those lives, I would have figured out how to raise my mileage without getting hurt. I would have found a different pair of shoes or a different place to run or a different, you know. So I think I'm 100% a believer in genetics. Like there's just no doubt. Like you can, you know, I went to my daughter's elementary school cross country a few days ago, and you can see they're 6 years old, and there's differences in how people run, and those, they're not perfect predictors, but they do track with, you know, who has the potential to be really fast someday and who doesn't. So genetics is real. But in my case, I would say genetics wasn't the ultimate factor that dictated where right. where I stopped. And for most of us, that I think that's the case. We don't get, I think there are very few people walking on this planet who can say, yeah, that time I ran, my best time, that's as fast as my genes would permit me to run.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's very difficult to reach your genetic potential, which is 99.9% faster than your PR, because all things yeah. perfect. Yeah. And geez, 21, I mean, you know, you had another decade, especially these days where people prolong their careers for progression
and
improvement.
I did try it. I did try. So I missed a few key years. I tried really hard from, you know, 25 to 28. And I, you know, when I was 28, I was probably in the shape of my life, I would say. And I got a stress fracture in my sacrum 3 months before that year's Olympic trials. And that was kind of the end of my track days. I said, I've had enough. I couldn't stay healthy. But yeah. it's not that I gave up. I tried and I couldn't run as fast as I did. And again, that's another thing I think that fuels my interest in trying to understand the limits of endurance. Because when I was 26, I was doing workouts that I could never have dreamed of when I was 21, but I wasn't racing as fast. And so was I a little bit overtrained, to go back to, you know, a point you raised before I started rambling several questions ago. Like maybe I was pushing too hard in the workouts, or maybe there was something different in my, you know, my confidence was different, or whatever the case may be. Like, I sometimes think about, you know, workout to race conversion. Everyone has a different, you know, if one person does 5 by a mile at such and such a time, you know, they're going to race at a certain level. But someone else doing that workout might race at a completely different level. And what determines those conversions? How do you know how the relationship between what you can do in training and then that sort of magic alchemy of racing, where you can always, or hopefully always, get a little more out of your body than you can during workouts?
Hey, ladies. You may have heard me talk about Gainswave treatment for improving male penile vascular health and sexual function, and maybe you thought, hey, what about my needs? Well, Gainswave has got you covered with a revolutionary new treatment protocol called Gainswave for Her. As with the male Gainswave treatment, a skilled practitioner uses a handheld device to send low-intensity shock waves into your vaginal area to stimulate a healing response, promote increased blood circulation, and the growth of new blood vessels. After a series of 6 to 12 very brief treatments, which are painless but extremely effective, you get real results, with Gainswave reporting an 80% success rate. Some benefits. You will revitalize your intimate relationships with heightened sensation and arousal and enhanced pleasure and satisfaction. Don't contemplate invasive procedures or uncomfortable medical treatments. Regain confidence and reclaim your sexuality with Gainswave for Her. You visit the website gainswave.com, GAINSWAVE.com/Brad, to find a practitioner in your area. You complete a series of treatments, and the beneficial effects will last for a long time, especially if you eat and exercise well to promote overall vascular health. It's a tune-up for your equipment, so please visit gainswave.com/Brad to find a practitioner in your area and take advantage of my special promo that you'll mention when you find your local practitioner. Buy 6 treatments and get one free. Right. And there's examples of those, what do you call them, training superhero, where they're not even close to their competitive potential. And apparently due to excess energy expenditure in workouts and those overtraining patterns, or that overly competitive, you know, lack of regulating your competitive intensity.
Yeah, and it's hard to know what, like, how much of that is they're tired, right? Like they're not recovered from the workouts, and how much of that is like something that's more subtle, that they're digging into some sort of, it's not the energy stores, but some sort of mental stores that you don't have, you know, you can't go to the sixth gear twice a week and then expect to really be able to harness it in a race too. I don't have the answers here, but I think that the questions point us in some interesting directions as to how do you figure out what that balance is of pushing hard enough, but not too hard.
Kevin Young, when he broke the world record in 1992, 400 meter hurdles, which held for a long time until recently, he was working with my friend, Dr. Greenberg. And one of the psycho-emotional things he was trying to clear was fear of success, because a lot of athletes, when they're training so hard and they're living and breathing their sport and their competitive goals, there is an unknown, or I guess unacknowledged, fear of what happens when I do reach all my dreams, then what? And you get that letdown, which is often talked about, the post Ironman blues, they call it, or what have you. So maybe deep down people are afraid to, they put their goal time on the sticky note and obsess about it, but are afraid to actually transcend.
It's one of those things that sounds so funny, but I think there's some truth to it, the idea of fear of success. But I think I something I've always thought is that one of the ways that running has prepared me for life is the realization that achieving your goals or meeting your dreams, you don't just sort of magically shimmer up into paradise when you like. So when I ran 3:52, I exceeded all of my dreams and it was great and I loved it. But a week later, I was, you know, life was back to normal. And it's like, okay, what's next? What can I, as soon as you get there, you're wondering what's next. And that's a kind of, it's good and bad, right? Like it keeps you going, but you know, I think many of us, let's say, need to work on enjoying the victories when they come, as opposed to always thinking about the next thing. But I know when I think about career or even relationships and all these things, I think running has prepared me well for the idea that even if everything I'm dreaming of comes true, life will go on the next day and I'll have to think of other dreams, because you can't just sort of float on that cloud indefinitely. And so whether you reach your running goals or your athletic goals or whether you don't, I'm descending into cliches here, but ultimately it is the journey, not the destination. Because I was lucky enough to meet some of my running goals. It was great, but it does, you can't live on that for the rest of your life.
And I suppose if you are able to appreciate the journey as the essence of what you're doing, according to some of this research that you cite in the book, it's possible to smile your way, self-talk your way into a reduction in perceived exertion. In other words, I love these workouts so much, irrespective of my goals and my competitive measurements, that they're going to be more enjoyable and less strenuous.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is tying it back to what we were talking about earlier about as an analytical person, learning to being willing to accept that there's a role for the brain. The self-talk literature is the one that for me helped to sort of turn the corner for me, that you can do randomized trials of having people work on saying different things to themselves in the middle of some, an endurance, a time trial or whatever. And lo and behold, they have an effect on performance. What you're telling yourself, it alters your perceived effort. So if you're sitting there telling yourself, this is really hard, this is really hard, this is so bad, I hate it, then it's not surprising that if your perception of how hard you're working gets higher. And if you've got a big grimace on your face to show how hard you're working, that you feel like you're working harder. And as a result, you slow down. And whereas if you're telling yourself, this is where I want to be. I there's no place in the world that I'd rather be. I chose to be here. And it's uncomfortable, but that's what I've chosen and it's okay. I can deal with it. Then you're like, oh yeah, this is 6 out of 10. It's tolerable. I can keep going. And you do. And so those studies that have actually shown an effect, they help convince the analytical part of my mind that, yeah, this isn't just a whole bunch of sort of touchy-feely, feel-good stuff. This is science.
I guess it could even count if you're thinking silly things like, I just want to come second to last. I don't want to be last. or I'm not going to lose to this jerk. He's wearing sneakers and I have the springy $250 shoes. It'll like propel you forward, even if it's sort of a negative or a simplistic notion like that.
And I think that, you know, it's definitely worth acknowledging that everyone's wired differently, right? Like some people, and anytime I discuss the sort of the idea of positive self-talk and you know, smiling and stuff, I'll run into someone who's like, personally, I run my best times when I'm mad, you know, when I'm pissed off and angry at somebody. And, you know, I'm not saying that's not true, that everyone's different. And even like response to pressure. So for me, I was someone who got pretty wound up before races. And so for me, saying all I need to do is come second last, so I'm not the asshole who came last, that was probably a good approach for me, you know, at least in the context of a field of runners, all of whom were fast, and that, you know, I that staying with would be good because it took the pressure off. I wasn't worried about covering the moods of the guys who were in for second and third. For other people, or let's say for a stronger runner, that would have been a terrible strategy for someone who's trying to win the race. If you're just saying all I need to do is come second last, you're going to underperform. So there's a sort of infinite variety of ways that your own personal psychology can interact with the specific situation where you're racing. But the sort of the common denominator is you have to find ways of, you know, of not necessarily encouraging yourself, but of creating space for yourself to push without being scared of the consequences of whether things don't go as well as you hoped.
So back to this idea of, okay, we're going to embrace our power, and our mindsets are the arbiter of fatigue in the body. We can self-talk our way and smile our way to reduce perceived exertion. And then here's Alex with another injury to the sacrum, ending his running career, and all the setbacks I've had, where I can reflect back and go, oh, geez. I love high jumping so much in the old man division that I busted up my heel, and now I need to have a minor procedure, and I'm not going to be jumping for a while. And it was clearly because I was out there unleashing my competitive intensity to the extreme that my body couldn't take it. And so the central governor does fine when I'm at my 15th jump in practice, and I know I have five more in me because I'm so enthused about it. But then where do you put the governor on in general everyday life, so that you're not leaving your best results in the training ground?
If I had the perfect answer to that, I'd be a millionaire, obviously, and lots of people are trying to sell us on their products that will monitor training and recovery. I think one thing I would say is I would distinguish between the discomfort or pain of effort and the discomfort of an injury. And it's not always easy to tell those two things apart. I mean, if as a runner, if every time you felt an ache or a pain or an ankle, you're like, well, I'm going to be smart and I'm going to take a couple of days off until this ache clears up. Yeah. You would run 10 miles a year, right? Like you have to be willing to push through discomfort sometimes, even acute physical discomfort. But I think the central governor, we can talk about it in the context of pushing through the desire to stop. But acute pain, localized to one particular part of your body, that we have to not rely on the central governor to protect us from. That we have to use our conscious cognitive resources to say, all right, how many days have I had this discomfort? Is it getting better or worse? Is it increasing during exercise, or is it sort of numbing during exercise? Is it worse when I get up in the morning? And, you know, and even if you know, if you're paying attention to all these things, it doesn't necessarily mean that you know whether you can push through things. But I think we have to take active ownership of the kind of mechanics of keeping our bodies working. And again, it depends, you know, if you're training for a race, a local race, then you just want to do the best you can, versus if you're trying to make the Olympics, you might make different choices on the cost benefit, the risk reward ratio of taking a day off versus pushing through something. These days I still run, I still compete, but it's not, you know, central to my life. And so if something starts to hurt, then I'm more inclined to just back off. But at the same time, as we're talking today, like I'm going to be running the provincial, maybe national masters cross country championships this year for fun. My heel's been bugging me for the last couple of days. I suspect it's probably plantar fasciitis or something like that. But I have a big workout this afternoon. My weekly workout with my friends, I go down and we do a good cross country workout, and I'm going to go to the workout. And there is a voice in my head that's saying, Alex, you know, if you let plantar fasciitis become like established, it's going to be a pain in the neck or a pain in the heel for a long time. Don't play around with this. But at the same time, I'm like, there's less than a month. There's 3 weeks until the cross country championships. This is the key workout. This is the prime time. So these are hard trade-offs to make. But I guess the key thing is I'm not just relying on my body or my brain to automatically know that this is the when I need to shut down. And I'm not pushing through I'm not pushing through a sort of defense mechanism. I'm coolly and calmly weighing the pros and cons and maybe acknowledging that I'm not as rational as I think that I'm being pulled along by my desires.
He's looking from the 30,000 foot view. Okay, there goes that guy with his stiff heel running another workout with his buddies.
This is, don't do what I'm doing. Do what I know what I should be doing. I'm just choosing not to do it. So maybe that's a different form of not central governor, the reverse, the central idiot or whatever.
Central breaker, yeah. It amazingly seems like even at the highest elite level of sport, we're not doing a great job at keeping the athletes healthy. And it could be part and parcel to trying to shave those tenths off the existing records and get the gold medal. But I'm also curious if we're missing, you know, a giant big picture insight where, you know, these multi-million dollar NBA basketball players or football players are rushed back onto the court because in the name of being professionals, and they don't want to miss too many games. And same with the Olympic athletes. And we had the great 800 meter runners from America that were picking up medals and looking like they were, you know, marching toward the world record. And then they can't even get on the track to try the trials to make the next team due to injuries and other setbacks. And I don't know. What do you think? Is it going to be par for the course? Or is there, if you dreamed up and you were the coach of the Olympic team, would you do something different?
Yeah, I'm a little bit pessimistic. So I've had this conversation recently in the context of the new breed of thick ultra cushioned running shoes. And someone was asking me like, oh, well, do you think if people are training in these, people train in these, you know, cushier shoes, will it reduce injuries? Will it allow? And my response was, okay, maybe not. You can argue it in both ways, whether it's protective of injury. You can argue that maybe it's going to change your biomechanics in a way that's going to make you more susceptible to injury, or maybe the reduced cushioning is going to make you less susceptible to injury. But the bigger picture view is that, let's say hypothetically, that running in big cushioned shoes allows you, it reduces stress on your body. Then runners are going to train more. And they're going to train, and there's a concept called risk homeostasis, which is the idea that we sort of have everyone's different, but each person has a sort of level of risk they're willing to tolerate. And if you make, you know, the classic study on this is anti-lock brakes, which was done in, I think, somewhere in Germany on taxi cabs. They installed anti-lock brakes to see if it would reduce accidents. And it didn't. It just had the cab drivers drive faster. So they were able to go faster, and they ended up operating at the same level of risk. Now, risk, that does not to say like this argument gets extended to bike helmets to say that, oh, well, therefore bike helmets don't work because people will just bike faster. And I'm like, no, I don't believe that we have perfect risk homeostasis. You can do things that make you safer that you don't fully compensate for by, even if there is a little bit of, maybe you bike a little faster with a bike helmet, but I still believe bike helmets are, although the evidence is murkier than you'd think, I still believe they have likely benefits to protection. But getting back to the injury question, I think once the stakes are sufficiently high, as they are in professional sport, the athletes at the top level are not interested in self-actualization or like, I wonder how good I can be with, well, not taking any risks. Mm-hmm. They want to do whatever it takes to win. And if a shoe, and so they're making decisions that maybe give them a 30% chance of getting injured any given year. If a shoe lowers that, they'll just start training harder till they're back up to 30%. Not in a perfect way, and that's not to say that people can't make better decisions. But I think, yeah, I mean, fundamentally, with sport, we're at a level now of full professionalization where the only limit on how hard people train or how much time they spend or how much many resources they pour into their training is the point of diminishing returns. And that point of diminishing returns is probabilistic. So if, let's say, you decide, I'm going to stop at this level of training because then I can be pretty confident I'm going to make it to the start line in one piece. Well, you've got 10 competitors who are all going to train at a higher level, and eight of them might get injured because they're idiots. They're doing a risky thing, but two of them, just by the luck of the draw, are going to make it through. And so, if you want to get, or three of them, let's say, if you want to make it on the podium, ultimately you have to train at that self-destructive level of training because there's enough people doing it that some of them are going to survive. And so it becomes a probabilistic throw. And this is a very pessimistic view of the world,
Oh,
but
you're describing the NCAA distance programs at all the schools where there's
Yeah.
20 kids and seven of them make it through cross country injury free, and four of them excel to their potential, and then it's like survival of the fittest in the worst way, and it's
Yeah,
playing out everywhere. I mean, it's not even a bad comment. It's an accurate description of how we operate.
I mean, I think you'd be any honest NCAA coach would admit that, yeah, that's pretty much how it works. Because unfortunately, you can see that it's irrational for an individual runner to train that way. But like it or not, it's if you have a program and the goal of the program is to win, that's a rational way to run the program. I mean, yes, I mean, we all love the stories of the carefully developed runners who nurtured and protected, and a lot of coaches are honestly trying to do that for sure. But ultimately, if you want to, I mean, if you have the raw material and you can train them hard enough, then you don't need everyone to survive if you want to just score five.
All right, let's go try to find some honest coaches to admit they're grinding these guys through a meat market. So we talked about genetics a little bit, and now we've talked about how the elite athletes have been pushing the limits for a long time. And I'm wondering if you see that we've are bumping up against the ceiling with some of the world records, such as El Guerrouj holding this record now for 24, 25 years. He was a unique genetic talent. He trained harder than probably any human ever and lived that monastic lifestyle, which is no longer existent. I think today's elite athletes are pumping up their social media in between workouts rather than laying in a dorm and reading a passage from scripture or something. Same with Usain Bolt being 6'5" and having those excellent mechanics and all that. So I wonder what your reflection is on that. I guess I'm talking about track and field mostly because it's so easy to quantify.
Yeah, I think we can extend from track to all other activities, but track is one where you can see that you can plot the charts and you can see, I mean, the idea that we're in an era of diminishing returns is I think pretty hard to argue against. We've been in an era of diminishing returns for a long time.
And what do you mean by that?
No one's going to break the record by large amounts.
Oh, right.
That it's not like if you look at the curve in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, it's like people were taking chunks off world records left, right, and center. And then it does it, we're at this point it's kind of level. You
Except the
you're not ex
hurdles, the 400 hurdles.
well they well and that and that that's not the
Now
only
it's level.
exception, because before the 2008 Olympics, people were writing that, I mean, this article gets written, people, scientists write studies every 5 years or so showing that progress is leveling off and we're very close to ultimate limits. And then it's just like, well, except that Usain Bolt changed, broke the world record by a cumulative total of, I can't remember, 1.5% or something like that, something enormous. So, and you can retroactively say, oh, well, Bolt was a freak of nature. Well, it's like, that's who sets world records, is freaks of nature. And yes, he had tall legs, but we had a very mature world record. It's not like tall people didn't exist until 2007, right? Like, we had lots of tall people trying to sprint. Nobody set the world. All of a sudden, Bolt took it to a different level and others followed. And then we can look at marathon running. It's like, or all distance running. The shoes came in 2017-ish. There's been a huge change in a whole world records at basically every distance. And you can say, well, that doesn't count as progress because that's technology. So like, yeah, well, there was technology. I mean, I agree with that for sure,
Yeah.
but there was also technological change when all weather tracks came in and, fiberglass pole vaults. Like the history of progress in world records has always been intertwined with changes in the context and in the technology. So, or you could say, well, what happened in the, well, there were a lot of world records in the 80s. It's like, yeah, well, there were a lot of drugs in the 80s. There were a lot of world records, in the Eastern Bloc, and not just the Eastern Bloc for sure. And in the 90s, there were a lot of world records. Well, there was no EPO test in the 90s, and there was EPO. So it's like we're approaching limits, except that every time we've never actually hit the limits because there's always something. And so I guess what I would say is there's this sort of hypothetical, pure idea of pure progress. It's like humans have gotten faster only by wanting it more or training smarter or doing something different. And I don't think we've necessarily maxed that out. Like I think especially for complicated to train, like endurance events are maybe there's more variables you can twist in terms of figuring out a way that, oh, maybe the Norwegians have figured out that doing four threshold workouts a week really is a better way, and you're going to get some progress. But so there's some wiggle room there. But I think what we're in the real world, what we're going to see is that world records continue to get broken. There will often be an explanation for why they got broken, whether it's a change in rules, a change in technology, a change in nutrition. Now you can get your carbs in a hydrogel that allows you to take more, whatever. So if you want to say those don't count as progress, then yeah, progress is going to be a little more rare. But I think I never would have predicted that shoes would allow runners to get a couple percent faster. Like I it literally never crossed my mind until it happened. And so that makes me open to the idea that something else that's somehow within the rules but has never crossed my mind might open up new performance vistas in one adventure or another.
I guess within the rules or right beneath the rules, when we're talking about the state of the union in doping, do you have any insights on that these days? I was fascinated to read Tyler Hamilton's book about microdosing EPO every night with a little pinch and then testing clean in the morning. It's like, okay, well, we see people climbing as fast or faster than Lance Armstrong up Alpe d'Huez and the measured climbs. And so to me, that's kind of an indication we had some good genetic talent and hard training there with the previous era. And if they're matching that now, I would have to project. I don't know. What do you think? Same with track and field question.
Yeah, I
I mean, we're
mean,
almost beating Flojo's records and some of the other people who were pretty well confirmed to be in competing in the doping era, if nothing else.
yeah, and in Flojo's case with a 5 meter a second tailwind when she's at 100 meter world record. But
Zero
anyway,
point zero. Okay.
oh, my mistake. Yes,
I call Elaine Thompson the fastest female of all time because that you got to throw things out. I mean, someone needs to have the guts to do that. Come on, Sebastian Coe, if you're listening.
exactly. That's a whole nother rabbit hole. Yeah, doping. Look, it's always going to be there. In the same sense that it doesn't matter what rules you make against stealing, there's still shoplifting. And just because people shoplift, it doesn't mean we should say not that you made this argument, but just because people still shoplift doesn't mean you should say, well, we tried getting rid of stealing, we should just make it legal because it's part of, no, it's a never ending fight. People will try and cheat. We need to stop them. How are we doing in this fight against cheating? I think the biological passport has narrowed the bandwidth available to dopers. You can't just be on the industrial strength diesel now, or at least it's much harder to do that. So I'm moderately optimistic in that sense. The fact that runners and cyclists are sort of performing as well or pretty close to as well as some admitted doped up previous generations. I don't know. I can, maybe it's just they're going to bed earlier and they're using their foam roller more religiously or whatever the case may be. Like, it's hard to know. And just in order to preserve sanity and to preserve interest in sport, I have to give people the benefit of the doubt and let, unless there's a certain amount of smoke that starts to, smoke beyond. I think the performance on its own is a tricky way of There is some interesting research with using performance trajectories to identify people who should undergo more targeted testing, and I think that's great.
Yeah,
But
Charlie Francis drew those graphs and it was widely ridiculed. Remember the spikes in the graph when he was showing the progression of world records,
oh,
claiming that
interesting.
everybody was doping? They're like, what does this guy know? You know, well, he knew everything.
It turns out he knew everything. Yeah, I guess to sum up the doping thing, I think it's always going to be part of it. Hopefully the balance has shifted a little bit compared to where it was in the 80s and 90s, where I think things were pretty, and I guess actually in the 2000s too. But yeah, you have to, I mean, you have to keep your head not buried too deeply in the sand. Even if you want to be optimistic, you have to acknowledge that every performance is subject to the possibility that it was that was cheating, and that's
Yeah,
it's sad, but it's true.
I like to make the assumption that the playing field is level. And so if we have eight lanes in the finals of an explosive event like the 100 meters, and there's doping suspicions because someone breaks a record, I'd like to think that all eight participants have equal access to whatever advantages are they're getting. I mean,
That's
same
an
with
interesting
looking
way of
at
thinking about it.
the NFL, Miami's playing Cleveland, and these guys are big and fast and strong. So I'd like to assume that whatever they're doing in the weight room and with their needles is equal. It's pretty reasonable assumption to make.
I'll take a slightly more maybe
Nationalistic point of view,
no
Canadians are clean.
yeah, well that's for sure, but I'll take a slightly more delusional approach, let's say, which is that I like to imagine that there's some athletes who are choosing to compete clean, and that little by little we'll keep chipping away, even if it's retroactively, at the ones who are found to have cheated, and that virtue will be rewarded. I think that's not a assumption that can probably bear intense scrutiny in the real world, but I sleep better hoping that some of that it's not just that everyone's doping equally, but some people are doing it right. And it's hard to just do a sniff test and figure out who's doing that, other than you get nationalistic involved. I know the Canadians are doing it right because I met that person's cousin's aunt's roommate's friend, 6 years ago. But I hope some people are. I know some people are doing it right. I know some people are doing it right and competing at the highest levels.
Oh, for sure. And I had Shelby Houlihan on the show, and it was such a heartbreaking story to, I'm deeply convinced that all her character shows is that she's, into the highest ideals of sport and appears to be a tragic victim of the system that's trying to go out there. And perhaps we've gone overboard when you talk about that balance of power in the 80s. The dopers own the world sports scene, and now perhaps the anti-doping agencies are causing some tragic fallout from doing the best they can to test at higher levels of scrutiny that might not, line up well with reality.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't have a perfect solution to that, because you can't have zero tolerance without having innocent victims, and there's no such thing as a complete lack of false positives. And so, I don't know how you identify those, and I don't know how you deal with it. It's one of those problems that it's like, even if I was unilaterally appointed the absolute king of anti-doping or of world athletics or something like that, I don't know that I have a great solution to that. I don't know how you come up with rule because you would come up with rules that can be applied impartially to try and solve those problems. I do think, yeah, accountability is important, and world anti-doping agencies should definitely have an obligation to accountability and to explain the procedures. But it's no test is perfect. That's tricky.
I do like your shoplifting analogy. I think that's the first time I've had a shoplifting associated with doping, but it's great. You got to keep fighting the battle and put on more cameras and follow them out to the parking lot, whatever. You
Yeah,
can't just lie down.
just assume that, oh well, we tried getting rid of shoplifting, and I guess we should make it say it's okay. No, it sucks that people still do it, but we've got to keep fighting it.
Alex Hutchinson, great stuff. Thanks so much for joining me. Listeners are going to have to grab that book, Endure. It's a wonderful read, wonderful listen. And where else can we connect with you, or got any exciting projects you want to talk about, or?
Well, thanks so much for this conversation, Brad. I'm sorry. Many of my answers were extremely rambling, but you asked interesting questions and we
That's
had
how
a
we
good
roll, man. It was great. Yeah.
Yeah. So probably the easiest place to find me is on Twitter. My handle is Sweat Science, all one word. Yeah, I mean, anytime I write an article in a place like Outside, I post it there. So that's the sort of one-stop shop. I'm working on another book, but by God, it's going slowly. So it'll be a while before it gets out. But
Believe in yourself, man. You can do it. You belong
that's
there.
right. I'm
Yeah.
at the 401 stage. Hopefully, I'll get to the 352
Okay. I
stage of the
love
book
it. Yeah.
before too long.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Dum, 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 dum.
Hey, ladies. You may have heard me talk about Gainswave treatment for improving male penile vascular health and sexual function, and maybe you thought, hey, what about my needs? Well, Gainswave has got you covered with a revolutionary new treatment protocol called Gainswave for Her. As with the male Gainswave treatment, a skilled practitioner uses a handheld device to send low-intensity shock waves into your vaginal area to stimulate a healing response, promote increased blood circulation, and the growth of new blood vessels after a series of 6 to 12 very brief treatments, which are painless but extremely effective. You get real results with Gainswave reporting an 80% success rate. Some benefits. You will revitalize your intimate relationships with heightened sensation and arousal and enhanced pleasure and satisfaction. Don't contemplate invasive procedures or uncomfortable medical treatments. Regain confidence and reclaim your sexuality with Gainswave for Her. You visit the website gainswave.com, GAINSWAVE.com/Brad to find a practitioner in your area. You complete a series of treatments and the beneficial effects will last for a long time, especially if you eat and exercise well to promote overall vascular health. It's a tune-up for your equipment, so please visit gainswave.com/Brad to find a practitioner in your area and take advantage of my special promo that you'll mention when you find your local practitioner. Buy six treatments and get one free. Thank you for listening to the show. I love sharing the experience with you and greatly appreciate your support. Please email podcast@bradventures.com with feedback, suggestions, and questions for the Q&A shows. Subscribe to our email list at bradkearns.com for a weekly blast about the published episodes and a wonderful bi-monthly newsletter edition with informative articles and practical tips for all aspects of healthy living. You can also download several awesome free ebooks when you subscribe to the email list. And if you could go to the trouble to leave a 5 or 5-star review with Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to the shows, that would be super incredibly awesome. It helps raise the profile of the BRAD podcast and attract new listeners. And did you know that you can share a show with a friend or loved one by just hitting a few buttons in your player and firing off a text message? My awesome podcast player called Overcast allows you to actually record a soundbite excerpt from the episode you're listening to and fire it off with a quick text message. Thank you so much for spreading the word. And remember, be rad.